Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
In the spring of 1940, Hitler's armies smashed across the borders of the Netherlands and Belgium and streamed into the northern regions of France. The German Blitzkrieg moved swiftly to the west and to the south, splitting the British and French defenders, trapping the British army at Dunkirk, and forcing its evacuation from continental Europe. The Germans entered Paris on June 14th and forced France's surrender on June 22nd. The British now stood alone, awaiting Hitler's inevitable attempt to invade and conquer their island, or so they thought. Well, Great Britain was in trouble. The soldiers rescued from Dunkirk were exhausted by their ordeal. Worse, most of their heavy armaments lay abandoned and rusting on the French beaches. After a short rest, the Germans began air raids in early summer designed to seize mastery of the skies over England in preparation for invasion. They needed air supremacy over the English Channel. All that stood between the British and defeat was a small force of RAF pilots outnumbered in the air by 4-1. Day after day, the Germans sent armadas of bombers and fighters over England, hoping to lure the RAF into battle and annihilate the defenders. Day after day, the RAF scrambled their pilots into the sky to do battle, often 3, 4, or 5 times a day. Britain's air defenses bent but didn't break. By September, the Germans lost enthusiasm for the assault. Hitler postponed and then canceled invasion plans, turning his attention to the defeat of Russia. In appreciation of the RAF pilots' heroic effort, Winston Churchill declared, "Never before in human history was so much owed by so many to so few." Okay, that is a very brief overview of the bombing of England and the Battle of Britain. In this episode, I'm going to be focusing on this early part of World War II and what happened, but specifically, I'm going to look at RAF tactics used against German bombers, and also individual accounts of RAF pilots and civilians and other people. The inspiration for this episode comes from a specific listener question, Vic Austin, and he asks, "What I'd like to hear is a show covering RAF Fighter Command's role in the Battle of Britain and the key decisions or influence that Churchill had in daily operations." That's what I'm going to do in this episode, and I'm gladly answering Vic's question as I love to answer audience questions, and Vic is a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, so I am obligated to answer his question, but I do so with great enthusiasm, because this is an interesting slice of history. The Battle of Britain is famous in early World War II, but it's not just about the heroics of fighting German bombers. What we see is a rapid evolution in military avionics and military aerial tactics. Remember, this is the 1940s. This is only a few decades into human flight, and World War II is a watershed period in the use of air forces in warfare. And this is where you see the doctrines of air superiority and air supremacy being hammered out. You have to control the skies before you can do anything else. This wasn't a doctrine universally believed in the first few decades of aircraft. And some thought that if bombers could get through, then you had absolutely no defense whatsoever. That if a nation wanted to keep sending bombers, even if some bombers were shot out of the sky, eventually a few would get through and be able to bomb a city. So if one nation had enough bombers, there was effectively nothing you could do to counter them. And this is what some English people thought, who feared that the German aerial assault on Britain would ultimately succeed no matter what. So there's a lot to tackle in this episode. So what I'm going to do is first paint an overview from the perspective of Churchill and how he sees the Battle of Britain. Then I'm going to go into the specific RAF tactics in the Battle of Britain, and also the German Luftwaffe tactics as well, to see what they're thinking in the skies, and then we're going to look at personal accounts. So let's jump right into it, first looking at things from the perspective of Churchill. With Great Britain led by a man known for refusal to negotiate with Nazi Germany, the nation fell into one of its worst crises of the 20th century. Britain had a massive expeditionary force on the European continent, and this is in 1940. In about 6 weeks, Germany defeated the Western Allies. In May 1940, German soldiers trapped 400,000 British and French troops between the cliffs and the sea at Dunkirk, located on France's northern coast. British troops were evacuated across the English Channel by means of ship, yacht, and even rowboat. Had those soldiers been killed or captured, the Allied forces would have been critically short of manpower and likely been forced to surrender to Axis powers. Without any hope left from across the Channel, France surrendered to Hitler within 3 weeks. Churchill referred to this period as the darkest hour, and this is when the Battle of Britain takes place. The period between the fall of France in 1940 and the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941 saw Germany focus much of its military might on Britain when it alone stood against Nazi Germany and the Axis powers in Europe. During those 363 days, the British couldn't decide if it was worse to be invaded or see its nation be completely destroyed by bombing raids. Much of Europe was under Axis control. America had not yet entered the war, and many doubted it ever would, while the Soviet Union held a fragile alliance with Hitler. Observers thought the effort to be hopeless. U.S. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy sent reports to Washington of the increasingly dire nature of the war effort. His views were shared by military experts in Europe, America, and even Britain. One element of British public and political sentiment favored a negotiated peace with Germany, and among them was the British Foreign Secretary. But Churchill refused to consider an armistice. Although at times personally pessimistic about British chances for victory, Churchill told Hastings Ismay on June 12, 1940, that you and I will be dead in 3 months' time, his use of rhetoric hardened public opinion against a peaceful resolution and prepared the British for a long war. And for Churchill to maintain optimism of British victory in the darkest days of World War II required a sense of hope that appeared to some civilians and advisors to border on lunacy. In September 1940, German bombers began to appear over London. Hitler changed tactics in his attempts to subdue Great Britain. In the previous 2 months, the Luftwaffe targeted RAF airfields and radar stations in order to weaken the nation to the point that he could launch a German invasion. When he realized such an offensive launch was impossible, just because of the difficulty of amphibious assaults, and because it would deplete too much manpower from the Eastern Front, he switched to a campaign of fear and intimidation. Bombing London to ruin would demoralize the population to the point of hopelessness and surrender, so he thought. At 4 o'clock on September 7th, 348 German bombers, escorted by 617 fighters, bombed London for 2 hours. A second group arrived at 8 p.m., continuing attacks throughout the night. Bombing runs continued until May in a series of attacks known as the Blitz, reducing London and other cities to smoldering ruins. The early stages in particular, the first 57 days, saw German bombing raids day and night. The lowest moment is considered by historians to be May 10, 1941, when 1,500 civilians were killed by bombings on London alone. Much of the city was on fire. Residents walking to work quickly ran to underground stations when the warning sirens wailed. As they waited at air raid shelters, they knew that a well-targeted bomb could level the building and kill them all. In the worst incident, 450 were killed when a bomb destroyed a school building used as a shelter. Ernie Pyle, a war correspondent, described a night raid on London in 1940 as such. It was a night when London was ringed and stabbed with fire. They came just after dark, and somehow you could sense from the quick, bitter firing of the guns that there was to be no monkey business this night. Shortly after the sirens wailed, you could hear the Germans grinding overhead. In my room, with its black curtains drawn across the windows, you could feel the shake from the guns. You could hear the boom, crump, crump, crump of heavy bombs at their work of tearing buildings apart. Into the dark, shadowed spaces below us, while we watched, whole batches of incendiary bombs fell. We saw 24 go off in 2 seconds. They flashed terrifically, then quickly simmered down to pinpoints of dazzling white, burning ferociously. These white pinpoints would go out one by one as the unseen heroes of the moment smothered them with sand. But also, while we watched, other pinpoints would burn on, and soon a yellow flame would leap up from the white center. They had done their work. Another building was on fire. This is what Churchill sees from his perch. And as the nation stared at likely extinction, he made the case for British victory in his May 13, 1940 speech to the House of Commons. He shrugged off calls by some politicians, and allegedly a few members of the royal family, to seek accommodation with Hitler. Entitled Blood, Toll, Tears, and Sweat, It's one of his most well-known samples of his oratory and considered to be a masterclass of rhetoric. One historian called its effect on Parliament electrifying. The House of Commons, that had ignored him during the 1930s, during Churchill's wilderness years from British politics, was now listening and cheering him on. Churchill spoke as such. "You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. Victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival." The speech was not only rhetoric, but a call to action. This was his first speech as Prime Minister. He informed Parliament he would put national differences aside and form a national government that included all parties in order to wage a united war against Germany. He said he would tell them what he told his new minister. "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." So for the next year, Britain held its resolve. It was battered but didn't crumble. In fact, the war energized Churchill, who was 65 years old when he became Prime Minister. On June 18, 1940, Churchill attempted to lift up England following the fall of France and the successful evacuation of most of England's supporting forces from the continent. At the moment of great apparent danger to British national survival, he spoke not only of endurance, but of noble causes of which Britain was fighting, specifically freedom, Christian civilization, the rights of small nations. He said, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves, that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will say, this was their finest hour." His lofty rhetoric largely matched his governing strategy. On July 3, 1940, Churchill told Soviet Ambassador Ivan Maisky, "My general strategy at present is to last out the next 3 months." His mind was fixed on holding a feeble defense of Britain against German attacks until the Luftwaffe could focus its efforts elsewhere and they could regather their resources. Publicly, Churchill continued to uplift the nation with powerful rhetoric. He never considered the cause to be lost or allowed the British public to think that its leaders would abandon them. In Churchill's hundreds of speeches, memoranda, and even privately recorded remarks, he never appeared to doubt the ultimate outcome of British victory and German defeat. Before the Nazis turned their military machine away from Britain and toward the Soviet Union, giving Britain much-needed relief from endless waves of assault, Churchill confided to an aide that the British policy would be to continue to fight on. An American journalist wrote in 1941, "The responsibilities, which are his, now must be greater than those carried by any other human being on earth." One would think such a weight would have had a crushing effect on him. Not at all. The last time I saw him, while the Battle of Britain was still raging, he looked 20 years younger than before the war began. His uplifted spirit is transmitted to the people. Other military leaders notice his upbeat style and natural political instinct. American general officer Hap Arnold met him on April 19, 1941, describing Churchill as a huge personality who possessed the most wonderful mind. At dinner that night, Arnold observed that he found that Churchill had a wonderfully detailed knowledge of all phases of military operations, past and present. He said, "A tour of a military post with Churchill reminded me of one of Roosevelt's, in that everywhere he was received with great enthusiasm and spontaneous ovations. I noticed Churchill was able to change his manner, his approach, depending entirely upon the particular situation confronting him, or the plight or circumstances of the people with whom he was talking. He could register pathos, he could be gracious and winning in his ways, he could register sorrow or great joy, or be enthusiastic or sympathetic." So as the months rolled on, Germany appeared on the march to victory, but privately it waned under Britain's resolve. On May 1, 1941, Rudolf Hess, Hitler's top Nazi officer, fluent in English, flew to a meeting with British aristocrats to make an incredible offer. Britain, which at the time was losing the war with the Hitler-Stalin alliance, could have peace with Germany if it stayed neutral in the coming battle between Germany and Russia. Hitler even offered to evacuate France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Norway, and Denmark. The only conditions were that Germany keep parts of Luxembourg and Alsace-Lorraine. Also, that Churchill step down as Prime Minister and Britain give Germany a free hand in Eastern Europe. Hitler obsessed over controlling Russian farmland and resources, but Churchill refused to step down and the offer was rejected. Churchill's resolve was rewarded 7 months later when the United States announced its entry into the war following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Churchill then became certain of ultimate victory. In his telephone conversation with Franklin Roosevelt, the president told the prime minister that they were all in the same boat. Churchill later cabled the Australian prime minister, telling him that the involvement of the United States as a full allied partner made the end certain. Well, that's a view of the Battle of Britain from the outside and the public face of Churchill and cabinet members and some behind-the-scenes political negotiations. Now, let's actually look at the tactics in the Battle of Britain. And I looked at different military history websites, and there was a lot of great information, especially from the RAF Museum, where I looked at tactics from the British side. So we'll look at that first, and then we'll look at Luftwaffe tactics. Let me just paint with some broad strokes first before I get down into the details. One of the main ideas in military thinking at the time was that the bomber will always get through. For the attacker, the task was to inflict sufficient damage on the enemy to bring about his defeat. But the defender had to destroy enough of the attacking force to make it impossible for the campaign to continue. So the military thinking at the time was that with enough bombers, you were at a significant disadvantage on the defense because you had to swat all of these out of the sky, but they only had to get a few through. That's why so many were pessimistic about the Battle of Britain. The key players in this battle were fighter pilots. The Germans had to get sufficient bombers to their targets so they could inflict crippling damage to British infrastructure. A side effect of this would be that the RAF had to respond to such attacks, and that in the resulting dogfights, the experienced and seasoned German fighters could decimate the ranks of the RAF fighter command. So the aim of the British was to deny the Luftwaffe the freedom of action by attacking incoming raids, get through the protective screen of German fighters, and destroy the bombers. They believed that the Hurricanes, their fighters, could do this while the Spitfire could deal with the German fighters. But once combat started, it rarely remained so evenly divided. But with the adoption of more open formations, the RAF denied the Luftwaffe a total success. We'll get into more detail, but first let's look at Luftwaffe attacks, since they were on the offensive. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. In order to invade Britain, the Germans had to have air superiority over the English Channel. If not, the RAF and the Royal Navy would be able to destroy their invasion force before it reached the shore. Many naval experts have argued that, due to the type of flat-bottom barges built by the Germans, simply running a destroyer squad at full speed through their ranks would have caused many to capsize in the wake from the ships. The troops and their equipment would have suffered heavy casualties, and the invasion would have effectively stopped with little or no gunfire. So the Luftwaffe's command of the air was vital to any plan for an invasion fleet to successfully cross the channel. The German Navy, Army, and Air Force each had separate plans and ideas on how and when the invasion should be launched. There seemed to be little cooperation between them, and despite the impressive buildup of barges and other equipment in the channel ports, the actual detailed planning for operation, codenamed Sea Lion, was never really fleshed out totally. All depended on the success of the Luftwaffe for air superiority before the invasion could be seriously considered. Starting on July 10, 1940, the Luftwaffe attacked shipping convoys in the Channel and Channel ports. They also suspected the importance of the British radar masts and attacked the stations on the south coast, damaging some badly. One of the aircraft types used in these raids was the Stuka dive bomber. These were accurate and had been particularly successful earlier in the war when there's no effective fighter resistance. But when dive bombing, they were vulnerable to attacks against them, and the Hurricanes and Spitfires of Fighter Command found them easy prey. Because of their heavy losses, they were withdrawn from battle in mid-August. In this stage, in mid-1940, the Luftwaffe was probing British defenses, looking for weaknesses before a major assault could be launched. At the beginning of August, with German invasion forces and troop barges being assembled on the French coast, the raids against the south coast of England were increased in size. The Luftwaffe began the next stage of their plan, believing that the British early warning system had been destroyed. On August 13th, massive air raids began. Their aim was to destroy the RAF, either in the air or on the ground, in southeast England. To put pressure on the British defenses, the Germans set high and low-level raids to different targets at the same time. Sometimes low-level raids snuck past the radar stations, and the first warning the British fighter pilots had was bombs landing on their airfield. So several of the raids succeeded in achieving complete surprise. This pattern continued in September, and the situation became desperate. Small civilian airfields were used in emergency, as many RAF stations became badly damaged. The Spitfire and Hurricane could easily take off from grass fields, but the maintenance and spare supply situation became desperate. Ground crews worked in the open and suffered heavy casualties from the raids. Many maintenance facilities were destroyed in the bombing. But despite this, the crews kept the fighters as combat-ready as possible, fighting in their own battle on the ground as the pilots were fighting up in the air. Some suggestions were made that fighters should be pulled back north of the Thames, but British command knew that this is exactly what the Germans wanted, which would have effectively given them air superiority over the intended invasion area. So squadrons stayed and fought for their lives there. To keep up the pressure, Germans began night raids to stop the defenders from repairing damage overnight. On one night raid, some aircraft bombed civilian areas of London by mistake. And this was a mistake that became a crucial turning point in battle. Hitler had specifically banned attacks on civilian centers, and he was still hoping that the British would become demoralized and sue for peace. But widespread civilian casualties could only harden the resolve of a nation to fight on, and this was the result. The British bombed Berlin in reply to this accidental attack. And fears grew that cities would be raided more often, so children were evacuated in a mass exodus to places of safety in the country, which also happened in 1939. But at this point, when it seemed the Germans were continually pressing on, they changed their tactics. Hitler was enraged by the attack on Berlin, and he thought that the attacks on airfields weren't destroying enough RAF fighters. So he ordered that instead attacks happen on cities and industry to break British morale and destroy the factories that built fighter aircraft. They also hoped that RAF fighters would gather in force around the cities to protect them, which would make it easier for the Luftwaffe to shoot them down. But this change of plans was a mistake. And this here is an opinion offered by the site Century of Flight that has a lot of avionics history and military avionics history. And that is that the change of plans was a mistake for a number of reasons. It gave the squadrons a chance to repair their airfields and radar sites so that defenses became fully operational again. The standard German fighter could only carry enough fuel for a 20-minute flight over Britain, so London was on the edge of its limited range. The German raids now came within the range of another group, 12 Group, and their large formation tactics known as Big Wings. The group that took the initial brunt of German assault, 11 Group, had different tactics than 12 Group. 11 Group's fast response tactics with whatever was available, and meeting the enemy formations as far from their targets as possible, was best suited to their geographical proximity to the German bases. Squadrons in 11 Group didn't have time to assemble, and they had to get airborne and climb to height as quickly as possible, or miss intercepting the raid altogether. But 12 Group was further north and had some more time for large attack formation of fighters to assemble and climb to meet the oncoming attacks. German command allowed the organizations to run as best as they saw fit, and detailed work being done on a group level, while German command dealt with the overall picture. Knowing that the target was now London and the industrial centers, British controllers had time to assemble a large number of fighters to attack German formations and break them up before they could bomb. The appearance of large numbers of Hurricanes and Spitfires came as something as a shock to Luftwaffe pilots, who thought that the RAF had been practically wiped out by the earlier raids. By changing tactics and targets, Germans had actually helped fighter command deal with raids. Well, for people living in the cities, this was the low point of the war, because night raids followed daytime raids and gave the civilians little rest, and this is when you get into the darkest hour period. Airborne radar was still in its infancy, but there were still some successes in detecting these formations coming. Beyond just the change in tactics, the structure of Luftwaffe fleets also affected how they dealt with the RAF. The organization of the Luftwaffe was very different from the RAF, which was organized into commands based on function. The Luftwaffe was arranged into air fleets, which were self-contained formations complete with fighter, bomber, and other elements. Three air fleets of the Luftwaffe, numbers 2, 3, and 5, were deployed to face RAF fighter command from across the English Channel in the North Sea. Fleet 2 undertook the main weight of operations against the southeast of England. Fleet 3 concentrated on targets in the western half of England, and Fleet 5 was used for diversionary tactics against northern Britain. The Luftwaffe had various problems which hampered its effectiveness in the Battle of Britain. It was designed as a close support weapon, moving with ground troops, not as an instrument for a strategic bombing campaign against a determined opposing fighter force. And its lack of heavy bombers made it difficult to inflict strategically significant damage on British targets. You just had to drop a lot of bombs that hit your target when you couldn't drop them with high precision. And the Luftwaffe's fighter force had no effective method of plotting the positions of fighter command aircraft and lacked any means of ground-to-air control of its machines. The Germans also suffered from supply problems and a lack of aircraft reserves through the battle, due to underachievement in aircraft production. The rapid advance through Western Europe in the spring of 1940 forced them to hastily establish a network of air bases across occupied Europe. Also, the Germans had difficulties establishing adequate local repair facilities, forcing the removal of damaged aircraft back to Germany for fixing. And there were also shortages of German aircrew. German fighter pilots were well-trained and had significantly more combat experience than RAF pilots, but it was difficult for the Luftwaffe to offset its losses of experienced pilots. Any RAF pilot who bailed out after being shot down over British territory could fly again. But Luftwaffe pilots who survived being shot down became prisoners of war. So those are German tactics. What about British tactics? In particular, I want to talk about the most common fighter formation used during the Battle of Britain. The tactics developed by the Royal Air Force were based on the premise that the attacking bombers would have to fly from airfields in Germany and would be without effective fighter cover. Fighter area attacks would see the squadron fly in a very tight three-aircraft formation over four sections with two sections per flight, meaning that a total of 12 aircraft with only the lead aircraft able to search for the enemy aircraft. Once they spotted the hostile aircraft, the squadron would position themselves according to the fighter area attack chosen. During the Battle of Britain, a typical Royal Air Force fighter squadron was to have at least 16 aircraft to enable 12 aircraft to be used while the other were being serviced or out of action, although at times, some squadrons were unable to meet this number. The squadron would be split into four sections. Each section was led by a section leader with two wingmen, with a color and number identifying each aircraft. So, for example, if you were the red section leader, you would be known as Red 1. When the battle began, the Luftwaffe were able to operate from the airfields in France, enabling German fighters to escort their bombers all the way to England. So when the RAF and Luftwaffe met in the skies above England and the English Channel, the ineffectiveness of the fighter area attack tactic was soon exposed. As with only the lead aircraft was able to look for the enemy, while the others concentrated on keeping formation, an attacking aircraft could catch the formation by surprise. Over time, Britain adapted its tactics, and as the summer ran into October, the German daylight bomber losses became too heavy. The bomber force started to operate only at night, and the damage they caused to Britain's cities was enormous. The German raids continued, but the RAF had started to develop night fighters equipped with radar, which could tackle the problem. The first AI, or airborne intercept radar sets, were being fitted to different aircraft and proved increasingly effective as the equipment developed and operational experience increased. Over time, the Germans realized the RAF couldn't be defeated in 1940. Germany was also preparing to attack Russia, so Operation Sea Lion was canceled indefinitely and eventually abandoned. So the Battle of Britain, it was the first to be decided purely in the air and the first real test of air power as a defensive and offensive weapon. But the battle didn't end with anything decisive. Really, it just petered out. All right, now let's close out this episode by looking at some personal accounts. First, I want to give a litany of quotes from different British pilots, and then I want to dig in much deeper with the account of 21-year-old pilot officer John Beard. So here are some different accounts from pilots. Tom Neal said, "We did nothing but take off, shoot at the enemy aircraft, land, go to sleep, take off again, do exactly the same thing, 3, 4, 5 times a day. That was our life. The Battle of Britain, to me, was just a horrendously tough rugby match in which the penalty of losing was death. Whereas in a rugby match, you probably break a leg or a collarbone or something like that. There, the penalty was much more severe." Arthur Bonzel, a British worker who worked on breaking the German Enigma code, is an example of how important the radar interception stations were. so that you could know what the Germans were doing and planning. He said, there were two wide stations, the interception stations, which belonged to the Royal Air Force, one at Cheadle in Staffordshire and one at Kingsdon in Kent. The one at Cheadle was intercepting the communications of German bombers. They were able to give forewarning of attack to fighter command because they could hear the Germans getting ready to take off. They tuned up their receivers and so on to make sure they would be in good contact with each other during the battles. It meant that Cheadle could warn fighter command even before radar had a chance, because at that point, of course, the aircraft wasn't even in the air. That was quite valuable. Geoffrey Wellham, a squadron leader and British pilot, said, that day was just like any other. Lots of Germans about. We were intercepting big raids coming in and defending this country against an evil regime. All the days were the same. Take off, fight the war, land, survive, take off again, and so it went. Now let's look at the account of pilot officer John Beard. In the summer of 1940, he was 21 years old and a member of a squadron of Hurricanes based near London. He was waiting on the airfield while his plane was being rearmed and refueled. He then received the word of a large German attack force making its way up the Thames River towards London. Beard and his fellow pilots lifted their planes off the grass strip and climbed to meet the enemy. The defenders leveled off at 15,000 feet and waited for the attackers to appear. Here's what he says. Minutes went by. Green fields and roads were now beneath us. I scanned the sky and the horizon for the first glimpse of the Germans. A new vector came through on the radio telephone, and we swung round with the sun behind us. Swift on the heels of this, I heard Yellow flight leader calling through the earphones. I looked quickly toward Yellow's position, and there they were. It was really a terrific sight and quite beautiful. First, they seemed just a cloud of light as the sun caught the many glistening chromium parts of their engines, their windshields, and the spin of their airscrew discs. Then, as our squadron hurtled nearer, the details stood out. I could see the bright yellow noses of the Messerschmitt fighters sandwiching the bombers, and could even pick out some of the types. The sky seemed full of them, packed in layers, thousands of feet deep. They came on steadily, wavering up and down the horizon. Oh, golly, I thought, golly, golly. And then any tension I felt on the way suddenly left me. I was elated but very calm. I leaned over and switched on my reflector sight, flicked the catch on the gut button from safe to fire, and lowered my seat till the circle and dot on the reflector sight shone darkly red in front of my eyes. The squadron leader's voice came through the earphones, giving tactical orders. We swung around in a great circle to attack on their beam into the thick of them. Then, on the order, down we went. I took my hand from the throttle lever so as to get both hands on the stick, and my thumb played neatly across the gun button. You have to steady a fighter just as you have to steady a rifle before you fire it. My Merlin, the airplane's engine, screamed as I went down in a steeply banked dive on the tail of a forward line of Heinkels. I knew the air was full of aircraft flinging themselves about in all directions, but hunched and snuggled down behind my sight, I was conscious only of the Heinkel I had picked out. As the angle of my dive increased, the enemy machine loomed larger in the sight field, heaved towards a red dot, and then there he was. I had an instant's flash of amazement at the Heinkel proceeding so regularly on its way with the fighter on its tail. Why doesn't the fool move, I thought, and actually caught myself flexing my muscle in the action I would have taken had I been he. When he was square across the sight, I pressed the button. There was a smooth trembling of my Hurricane as the 8-gun squirt shot out. I gave him a 2-second burst and then another. Cordite fumes blew back into the cockpit, making an acrid mixture with the smell of hot oil and the air compressors. I saw my first burst go in, and just as I was on top of him and turning away, I noticed a red glow inside the bomber. I turned tightly into position again, and now saw several short tongues of flame lick out along the fuselage. Then he went down into a spin, blanketed with smoke, and with pieces flying off. I left him plummeting down and, horsing back on my stick, climbed up again for more. The sky was clearing, but ahead toward London, I saw a small, tight formation of bombers completely encircled by a ring of Messerschmitts. They were still heading north. As I raced forward, three flights of Spitfires came zooming up from behind them in a sort of Prince of Wales feathers maneuver. They burst through upward and outward, their guns going all the time. They must have each got one, for an instant later, I saw the most extraordinary sight of 8 German bombers and fighters diving earthward together in flames. I turned away again and streaked after some distant specks ahead. Diving down, I noticed that the running progress of the battle had brought me over London again. I could see the network of streets with the green space of Kensington Gardens, and I had an instant glimpse of the Round Pond, where I sailed boats when I was a child. In that moment, and as I was rapidly overhauling the Germans ahead, a Dornier 17 sped right across my line of flight, closely pursued by a Hurricane. And behind the Hurricane came two Messerschmitts. He was too intent to have seen them, and they had not seen me. They were coming slightly toward me. It was perfect. A kick at the rudder, and I swung in toward them, thumbed the gun button, and let them have it. The first burst was placed just the right distance ahead of the leading Messerschmitt. He ran slap into it, and he simply came to pieces in the air. His companion, with one of the speediest and most brilliant get-outs I've ever seen, went right away in a half a Meltman turn. I missed him completely. Must have almost been hit by the pieces of the leader, but he got away. I handed it to him. At that moment, some instinct made me glance up at my rearview mirror and spot two Messerschmitts closing in on my tail. Instantly, I hauled back on the stick and streaked upwards. And just in time. For as I flicked into the climb, I saw the tracer streaks pass beneath me. As I turned, I had a quick look around the office, the cockpit. My fuel reserve was running out, and I had only about a second supply of ammunition left. I was certainly in no condition to take on two Messerschmitts, but they seemed no more eager than I was. Perhaps they were in the same position, for they turned away for home. I put my nose down and did likewise. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. All right, so that is an account on the RAF, the Battle of Britain, and the tactics used by both sides, and what it was like to be in the Battle of Britain, whether as a fighter pilot or Winston Churchill himself or a member of British High Command. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I am always happy to hear your suggestions on a topic like this that you would like me to cover. All right, well, that is the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, Moondoggy from Ohio, Vic and Irene, and Rick Knowlton, and I'll explain what that means in a second. If you like the show, please leave a rating review on the podcast listener of your choice, whether it's iTunes, whether it's Stitcher, Google Podcasts, whatever. Also, we have a Facebook page. You can join us there to keep up the discussion on latest episodes. And finally, if you really want to dig in deeper with this show, I encourage you to join the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you will be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.